Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 571. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about mosques and minarets, walled cities, Marco Polo, and Tamerlane as we go to Uzbekistan. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. We're going to be talking about some complicated names, or at least names that are not familiar to those of us who live in the United States or in Western countries today. So this might be a good opportunity to remind you that for every episode of the Amateur Traveler, there are show notes both at the website, amateurtraveler.com, as well as in the lyrics for this episode, if you want to see the names of the places or the people that we're talking about, as well as links to more information. That being said, let's talk about Uzbekistan. I'd like to welcome to the show Latish Sharma, who has come to talk to us about Uzbekistan. Latish, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Uzbekistan is not a very typical destination. Why were you in Uzbekistan?
A lot of things came together with Uzbekistan. I was fascinated with travelers like Marco Polo and Ibn Battuta. Mm-hmm. Following in their footsteps in Central Asia would take you to Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan is also a place where Islamic history and also history that predates Islam and the Mongol conquerors, Alexander the Great's campaign, all of that put together. I also found out after I went there that they have excellent food. They are a very welcoming culture. So all of these were good reasons for me to visit Uzbekistan.
Excellent. Well, I guess that answers the question of why people should go to Uzbekistan.
Yeah, those are the reasons, yes. For example, Samarkand, and I think this summarizes it very well. So Samarkand is on the UNESCO World Heritage Site, and I think the description is crossroads of culture. Mm-hmm. And I think that summarizes Uzbekistan very well. Although it is in this one remote corner of Central Asia, I mean, not really a corner, it's actually in the middle of everything else, but it's situated in a place where it has benefited from being at the crossroads of a lot of traffic.
Well, and you mentioned two famous travelers who have been to Uzbekistan, but I suspect that some of our listeners only know one of those, who is Marco Polo. Tell us a little bit about who the other one is.
Ibn Battuta was a Moroccan from the city of Tangier. One day, I think he was a young man, and he decided that he's going to visit every Muslim land, if I recall correct. So he started on a 20-year journey, which took him across North Africa into the Arabian Peninsula for the Hajj. And then he kept on traveling. He went as far as Central Asia, South Asia, Turkey, all of those. And he made his way back to Tangier. You can actually visit his grave.
Okay. I didn't realize that's where he was buried. And so this was in the 1300s.
Yes, that's about right. I think he and Marco Polo were contemporaries, at least for part of their lives.
Okay. And what kind of itinerary do you recommend for Uzbekistan?
The highlights of Uzbekistan are the cities of Hiva. It's spelled with a K, but the K is silent, so it's H-I-V-A is how you pronounce it. Bukhara and Samarkand. These three are the main draws of Uzbekistan. You will be transiting in and out of Tashkent, and you'll lose some time there. So if you have a week, I would give maybe about 2 days, 3 days to each of these cities, Hiva, Samarkand and Bukhara. You know, whatever time you have at Tashkent, you can take in some of the sites. But really, Tashkent won't be your highlight.
Okay, I was going to say that was the impression I was getting from what you were saying. Well, let's start in Tashkent since we're transiting through there. What do you recommend that we do see while we're in the city?
So between our arrival at Tashkent and our connecting flight to Urganch, we had a few hours. So we took a trip to see the Chorsu Bazaar, and we've been to a few bazaars, but Chorsu Bazaar certainly felt a lot more authentic. It felt a lot more real, and it was a very good experience. You know, they have sections where they are selling dried fruit, another section where they are selling locally produced nuts and fruits. Then they have a dairy section. And strangely, there's also a Korean community in Uzbekistan. So
really?
We had actually very good kimchi at the Chorsu Bazaar.
Okay. Is that a North Korean community from the Soviet days? Or what is the connection between Korea and Tashkent?
Yeah, I think these are Koreans from the far, far east of Russia. So in the Kamchatka area, borders North Korea.
Okay.
Some of those people were resettled in Soviet times in different parts of the remainder of the Soviet Union. Hmm. And there is a community of these Korean people in Uzbekistan as well.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, kimchi was not what I was expecting you were going to say there. Well, and you talk about this being an authentic bazaar. And by that, I'm thinking that you mean that it is not aimed at tourists. It is just what the locals are buying. And you're seeing a more slice of life sort of thing. Is there a lot of tourism in Uzbekistan right now?
There are tourists, but it's not overrun with tourists, but you will keep running into tourists at most of the major sites. The tourism in Uzbekistan is mostly from Europe, so French, German, and tourists from the former Soviet Union. So those are the only travelers I met while I was there.
Okay. What should we see next?
Besides the Chorsu Bazaar, there are some mausoleums and madrasas in Tashkent, where you could spend some time if you have the time. I wouldn't specifically add them to the itinerary. I would rather that you go on to the main highlights of Uzbekistan.
And before you go on to the main highlights there, you lost me at some point. You said mausoleums and madrasas. And I know the first word.
Being at the crossroads of culture, Uzbekistan has been a center of Islamic learning.
Sure.
So madrasa is an Islamic school. And
are
literally dozens, if not hundreds of them through the ages in Uzbekistan. Many of them are places where you can go visit and see Islamic architecture, etc. Every city has at least, for example, Tashkent, Kiva, each of them, you would definitely see multiple madrasas. Some of them are definitely worth a visit.
Okay. And was there one in particular in Tashkent that you thought was more interesting?
There's one quite close to the Chorsu Bazaar. The name I cannot recall at this point.
Okay.
Yeah, but I think you would see much better madrasas in any of the other three cities than you would at Tashkent. You should visit the ones in Tashkent if you have more than a few hours and you've already seen the Chorsu Bazaar. And then you can add some of those to your itinerary.
Okay. Sounds good. So after Tashkent, where are we off to?
You're flying to Urganch. You can also take a train. You can also take a long bus journey. Certainly, the flight and the train are the more comfortable options.
Okay.
The plane takes you into a city called Urganch, which is, I'm guessing, about 20 miles from the town of Khiva. And there you can take a taxi to take you from the airport into the town of Khiva.
And we're way at the northern border with Russia at this point, I think.
No, I believe it's the southern end towards Turkmenistan.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Khiva is, again, from memory, I don't have a map in front of me. I think it's only about 5 miles or less as a crow flies from Turkmenistan.
Okay.
Khiva is a medieval Silk Road trading town where it's at the edge of the desert. It's an oasis. And lots of caravans loaded with Silk Road trade goods would stop there, they replenish, do some trading, move on. So it is one of those classical merchant towns of the Silk Road.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the desert. It's a lot of it is adobe construction and a little bit, and some brick construction. The town itself is been there for many, many centuries, I'm guessing, before the 10th century. However, because it's adobe and brick and all that, it has been rebuilt many times. The current shape of the town is, if I recall correct, around the 15th, 16th century. So that's the current vintage of the buildings there.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it is so otherworldly. When you go there, it feels like nothing else that you've seen. The entire town, it's a walled city.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's a new town.
Not a brick-walled city, it looks like.
It is a mix of adobe and brick.
Okay.
So you would see that there would be some buildings, some walls made of something that looks like adobe, mm-hmm. and there is also some buildings made of brick, etc. It is on the UNESCO World Heritage Site,
mm-hmm.
deservedly so, because once you go there, you truly feel you are in the Arabian Nights or something like that, although mm-hmm. Uzbekistan is not Arab. But you certainly get this feel of Silk Road and enchanted town places, a place where time has kind of stood still. You will see a lot of people in their traditional dress. And if you're within the walled cities, you really don't see signs of modernity that are outside of these walls. There are hotels, and you can basically live your time in Hiva within the walled city, and you will really lose all sense of what century you're in.
Are there specific sites within the walled city that you would recommend?
I recall there are hundreds of homes, buildings, mm-hmm. monuments, etc., from the 15th, 16th century in the old town of Hiva. There are, I'm guessing, half a dozen mosques. The Juma Masjid is the biggest. It has a roof, and the roof is supported by hundreds of wooden pillars. Each of them are very well carved.
Mm-hmm.
That's a sight to see. In Hiva, you basically buy one ticket as you enter the town.
Okay.
And that ticket allows you entrance into the town, also allows you entrance to most of these buildings that are open to tourists. There are some exceptions. Some parts of some homes, some of the minarets in the town are owned privately by the family that has owned the home to which the minaret is attached for a long time.
Interesting.
So one of those is the Ismail Khoja Minaret. So that's something where you have to pay an additional fee.
Mm-hmm.
It's owned privately by the family. There's a home attached right to the minaret, and traditionally that was their minaret. So you buy a ticket from them, which is separate from the entrance, and you can go to the top of that minaret. It gives you a panoramic view of all of Hiva. There's this winding staircase within the minaret, as you can imagine, and it's pretty dark, and it's not for those that suffer from claustrophobia. Once you get at the top, the view is breathtaking, though.
Well, and a couple of things. You were talking about how old the city was, and I looked that up while you were speaking, and they believe it goes back to the 6th century, and then it's the current shape of, I think they're putting it around the 17th century in terms of the current walled city that we're seeing. So quite an old city.
Yep, it is. I was wrong on both of those dates by a couple of centuries.
Well, there's some slack there.
Once you arrive in Kiva and you look at the sites, a long journey from wherever you live all the way to Uzbekistan, it's a long journey. And the moment you get there, you will pat yourself on the back and say, yes, this is worth it.
Well, I noticed there's the traditionally story associated with the city is that it's associated with one of the sons of Noah, Shem, from whom we get the word Semitic, apparently was after the flood, found himself wandering the desert alone and woke up here, had a good dream, was pleased with the omen and founded the city is the traditional story of the founding of the city. So that's a while ago.
That's a while ago, yeah. While we are talking about history, there was a Persian mathematician who the word algorithm and the word algebra
mm-hmm.
are both derived from his name. If I pronounce it right, it's Al-Khwarzamini or some such variant. So he was a mathematician of Persian origin who was born in Hiva. So you can see actually a statue dedicated to him just outside of the city walls.
It's a little unusual to see statues of people in Islamic countries. So you threw me there for a second.
Yeah, that's actually something to talk about, because Uzbekistan has been a center of Sufi Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Their outlook towards depictions of animals and people is probably not quite as puritanical as some other interpretations of Islam.
Okay.
And you would see that. You would see that. So, for example, most mosques are welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be a Muslim to enter the mosque. And in many mosques, women could enter just as they are dressed. I mean, if you're in Uzbekistan, you're typically dressed a little modestly.
Mm-hmm.
And women don't have to cover, you know, head to toe. They don't have to put on the black abaya or anything to get into a mosque. You can just enter as you are.
Hmm. Interesting. I have to go back then to something you said previously. You talked about the mosque with the intricately carved pillars. I was assuming geometric shapes because I was just thinking mosque and no other depictions. What are intricately carved on the pillars of the mosque you mentioned earlier?
These are generally geometric designs.
Okay. it is the traditional design I would expect to see. Okay,
yes.
Cool. Anything else you want to mention about Kiva before we move on?
Side trips from Kiva. So this is one of the better preserved fortress towns. Mm-hmm. From what I hear, there are several within a short drive of Kiva. So if you're interested, you could explore some of those. I did not, but I just want to let you know that there are certain day trip possibilities from Kiva.
Excellent. Where to next?
Our next stop was Bukhara.
Okay.
It was a shared taxi ride. So we hired a taxi. We shared the taxi with a German traveler. And it was a long ride from Kiva to Bukhara on bad roads.
And when you say a long drive, we're talking hours, not days.
We're talking hours. It was about, I'm guessing, 7 hours or so.
Okay. Felt longer, though.
Felt much longer. And no air conditioning. So you felt like you were in a tin sauna and you were just waiting for the journey to end. When you look back on it, it feels like, you know, a very enriching part of your travel experience, but when we were going through it, it felt like torture.
Were there other options that you would recommend to people instead of the long shared taxi ride to get to Bukhara from?
You could fly, and I believe there is a train, but the train runs on a specific schedule.
Got it.
And that schedule wasn't working for us.
Okay.
So Kiva is relatively small. I think the walled part of Kiva is perhaps half a mile by a mile and about rectangular. Bukhara is a much bigger place, and the architecture and the sites are interspaced with the rest of the town. In Kiva, you have one wall that surrounds the whole town, and everything is kind of condensed in that small space. In Bukhara, it's more spread out, and you know there are people living in between those sites, and it's a regular town with, you know, buses, roads. A lot of Kiva is pedestrian only. So suddenly, you know, you're going from something which is medieval to something which has a lot of medieval sites, but also living with modernity, if you will.
Now, one thing that strikes me about both of these from the pictures that I have seen, and I'm curious if you know the background of this. So we're talking about cities that are in general the color of adobe, the color of sand, that kind of tan color. But then there are the caps for a lot of the minarets and towers are a lovely turquoise blue, which is quite striking. That contrast between that, is that a local mineral, which is why?
I wouldn't know that.
Okay.
But in terms of a visual impact, it certainly is quite striking. Mm-hmm. You see this entire landscape, mostly tan and adobe, and then you have these bright spots of blue on top of minarets, and it's certainly attractive.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It looks that way. And then more of the detail work seems to be darker blue tile work and those sort of things. But interesting. Color scheme seems like the wrong term for it, but I can't think of a better term for it. What else do we want to see in Bukhara?
In Bukhara, there are a lot of sites that you could see. So let me start. What we did is we hired a private guide. Mm-hmm. And one of those serendipity moments when you're traveling. So we got out of our hotel and we got talking with the street vendor quite early in the day, and we asked him, we are looking for a tour guide who can show us around. And this guy says, my mom is one. So he calls up his mom, and his mom shows up in 5 minutes, and it turns out that she's a university history professor or someone, very well educated, very well informed about the city and the various sites. And she takes us on a tour, and it was a enriching experience just because we had a good tour guide to show us what these sites were.
Well, and I'm assuming you were having that conversation in English rather than in Uzbek?
Yes. I was specifically looking for an English-speaking guide, and the guide that I'm referring to did speak very good English. So she basically met us near... So there are these architectural complexes. So there are a cluster of buildings which are basically in one compound, if you will. Mm-hmm. There's a history, and the guide walks you through what those are. And then there's a longish walk between such clusters. So I'll just walk you through about the route that the guide took us on.
Okay.
We started at a complex called Labi House. I think that's how my pronunciation could be way off. Mm-hmm. So it's basically a pond in the middle of the city. It's pretty central to where Bukhara is. Around it is a madrasa again. And There's a mosque on the other side.
How big a pond are we talking about here?
It's maybe about 2 basketball courts.
Okay. Relatively
small. It's not too big. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Here again, the madrasa, which is right adjacent to it, and we touched upon this when we were talking about depicting people. So on the facade of this madrasa, you would see peacocks and you would see a human face looking down on you.
Okay.
Again, these are not motifs that you would expect to see on an Islamic building.
Mm-hmm.
All of this is very intricate tile work,
mm-hmm.
Lots of blues, greens, turquoise. So the building generally would be tan, but these decorations would be, as you described, pop of color, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it would be very beautiful. We have the pond in the middle, we have the madrasa to one side, and then we have a mosque on the other side. And this area is generally surrounded by a lot of the traditional bazaars. So there's a street of moneylenders, which is right adjacent to the Labi House complex.
Mm-hmm.
So these were Jewish moneylenders, the Jews of Bukhara, who used to ply their moneylending trade there. Actually, the hotel that we stayed in, it is maybe about 50 meters from this pond. So the owner actually took me into one of the rooms which were not public, and he showed us that it was probably the home of a, not probably, certainly was, a home of a Bukharan Jew. And there were Hebrew writings on the wall. And this guy was certainly Muslim. And he was actually very proud to show off the Jewish culture of his city. So that was also something which struck me.
Well, the other thing I was reading that surprised me is that the language that a lot of the Bukharan Jews speak is Persian. And so these would probably be Jews who were taken off in the diaspora 300 years BC. Interesting.
So that's the Labi House complex. Moving further west, so there's the highlight of the city of Bukhara. So every time, probably if you go to the Wiki Travel page or if you open up a travel guide that talks about Bukhara, quite likely the image on the banner would be the Kalon Minaret, which is again a tan-colored tall
mm-hmm.
minaret.
Mm-hmm. Looks like a chess piece.
It does look like a chess piece. Yes, it does. Yeah. Because it just taper narrows towards the top and then it flares into a decorative top. Certainly makes it look like a chess piece. That's a good description. I believe that is also from the 10th century. It's been standing for a long time.
Hmm. Beautiful stonework.
It is very intricate. That minaret is next to a big mosque. And it's also adjacent to a large madrasa.
Mm-hmm.
So you would see this kind of pattern emerge in Uzbekistan. You would often see that there's a mosque and there's a madrasa right next to each other, usually well-preserved, well-restored, and you would see sites in this form of arrangement.
Okay.
This minaret, I understand, was standing when Genghis Khan came by Bukhara.
Hmm.
He sacked the city, but he liked the minaret. He thought it was beautiful, so he didn't destroy it. That's the legend.
Hmm.
So going further west, this is basically the route we took with our tour guide, is the Ark of Bukhara. So this is a citadel, a fortress. This is basically the hub of what Bukhara was.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that this Ark also dates from the 9th or the 10th century. When I went there, they were not allowing people in. They were doing some restorations. The Ark was closed, but you could walk from the outside. So they were restoring it. It didn't look in very good shape. We could see the difference between the restored part and the not restored part. Apparently, during the Soviet takeover, the Ark was badly damaged.
Okay.
So inside of the walls, there's not much to see. I understand there's a small museum that we couldn't get to. So that's the Ark from about the 10th century. A little further west is the Samoni Mausoleum. This is also a building from the 10th century, and our guide informed us that this is one of those buildings from the 10th century which hasn't been restored. So you're basically seeing the building as it was built 1,000 years ago. It is the grave of someone from the Samanid dynasty. I don't recall the details, but it's a small structure, but it's beautiful. It's entirely made of brick, and the bricks have been laid in very intricate patterns. So depending on the way that the sun hits the building, you see it very differently at different times of the day.
Hmm.
So that was it. Next to this Samanid Mausoleum is a monument to Imam Bukhari. Now, this is one of those things where we had an advantage of taking a guide. I would have spent some time looking at the monument, probably taken a picture or so, but she gave us some more background. Imam Bukhari was an imam from Bukhara who compiled a list or compiled a book of the sayings and the hadith of the Prophet Muhammad.
Okay.
There are many such compilations, but the compilations from this guy are considered the most comprehensive and authentic. And she told us that there is a mausoleum to this guy near Samarkand.
Mm-hmm.
And she told us that we should pay that mausoleum a visit if we can fit that into our itinerary. So we did that when we got to Samarkand, and this trip was well worth our time.
Okay.
That is about Bukhara. There are a couple of other sites as well. So if I go back to Labi House and then go further east, there is a Chor Minar. So it basically means four minarets.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a mosque. It's a mosque on which there are four minarets. It's another structure that you can take a look. There's a madrasa and a mosque again together. And there are some stores, shops selling souvenirs around it. So these are some of the highlights of Bukhara. There is a palace of the Emir of Bukhara, a short distance from the city, and you can pay that a visit too. So you can walk through some of the rooms of the Emir, and you can look at the water fountains where legend has it that all his wives would be frolicking in the fountain, and he would be sitting on a chair with an apple, and then he would toss his apple towards his favorite wife for that day, and then she would get to spend the day or the night or whatever with him until the ritual was repeated the next day.
Excellent. Anything else we want to see in Bukhara before we move on?
A couple of things I want to mention about, you know, hospitality and all that. So when we were on this tour with the guide, our guide took us to an Uzbek restaurant, a traditional restaurant. So we shared a table with her, we ordered a meal, and we were the only tourists there. The random people, you know, from two tables away, three tables away, they would come by and they'll ask you where you're from. And when they would hear that, you know, you're visiting from such and such country, they would welcome you. And they say, you know, just random acts of hospitality and very welcoming nature. Mm-hmm. Those are good memories to bring back from any travel.
Excellent. Now, the one thing you didn't say is, was the Bukhara also has sections of it listed as UNESCO World Heritage Sites. We're going to get tired of saying that, but by the time we get to the end of the show, because we're going to do that again here later on, but we should not leave it out for Bukhara.
Yeah. So Giva, Bukhara, and Samarkand, all three are on the UNESCO World Heritage Site. I don't think it's a specific site. It's the entire collection of architecture in each of those cities that has been listed on the UNESCO.
That's what it looked like when I was looking at it. So, yeah. Okay, excellent. Well, are we ready to go on to Samarkand then, or is there some other stop in between?
There's a stop in between that's only for changing taxis. So we get into a shared cab from Bukhara and we drive to Samarkand.
Okay.
The way it works is somehow there's a taxi service that only goes to a town that's about halfway, pronounced Navoi, who it's a city named after one of their poets, philosophers, the Soviet era city. So there's a taxi service which takes you there, and then there's another taxi you get into that takes you from Navoi to Samarkand.
Now, when you are getting into the shared taxi in Bukhara and heading out towards Samarkand, and I'm assuming you don't speak Uzbek.
I don't.
And that you're less likely to run into a taxi driver who speaks English. So
yes.
How does that work? Do you just say the name Samarkand and they point you in the right direction? Or did you have something written down? Or did you know that it was going to stop and you were going to have to change taxis?
I didn't know that. So actually that threw me off. So yeah, but it's a lot of miming. I don't speak Uzbek. I don't speak Tajik, which is
the second most popular language.
Yeah, I don't speak Russian, which is probably the third most spoken language there. So yeah, there was a lot of miming.
So you'd say Samarkand and they would point you someplace and you would...
Yes.
You would walk in that direction, confident that would get you there. Okay.
Yes. Since you mentioned language, it's interesting, right? Now, I did mention crossroads of culture already at the start of the program. So here's another example. So I was in the shared taxi going from Bukhara towards the first stop. And I have some people sharing the taxi with me. One of them happens to be a businessman who's a local. He doesn't speak English. I speak none of the languages that he speaks. It turns out that he is learning some Spanish. for his business reasons, he has clients or whatever, and he thinks that, you know, learning Spanish will work for him. I don't speak much Spanish. I speak more Spanish than I do Uzbek. Mm-hmm. So here we are in the middle of Central Asia in a shared taxi in Uzbekistan, and we are conversing in Spanish.
The other thing, actually, you talked about the culture and the mixing of the cultures and this being a crossroads. What we didn't mention with Charminar, the mosque that you mentioned in Bukhara, which has four minarets, that I was reading, was that on the different four minarets are the symbols of the four religions known to Central Asia. So there's the Christian fish, Buddhist prayer wheel, and as well as Zoroastrian and Islamic motifs. And that struck me as highly unusual to find that on a mosque.
That is interesting. I didn't know that.
You have to learn something from amateur traveler, apparently, even when you're on. So there you go. Excellent. We're off to Samarkand.
You would see, if I may go back to your previous point, that you would see a lot of Zoroastrian symbols.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
On mosques in Uzbekistan, and that's pretty normal. So you would see, for example, a lot of swastikas.
Oh, I think of that as being Buddhist rather than Zoroastrian.
What we learned was that the swastika is the ancient Zoroastrian symbol for the sun. And there are four arms to signify each season, and they are in a rotating pattern to show that the continuity of time and the cycle of seasons powered by the sun.
Oh, interesting. Because I know when I'm in China and I see the swastika, again, I'm not seeing a Nazi symbol. I'm seeing something that is a Buddhist symbol, and I can't think of what it stands for. You'll find Buddhas with swastikas on them. And again, if you are just used to the European use of it, it can be a little striking. It can take you back a little.
Uh-huh.
And the answer to that is what it means in Buddhism. It symbolizes the auspicious footprints of the Buddha, which I did not know. So, Samarkand.
So in Samarkand, again, it's a fairly large city. It was lots of huge buildings. In Samarkand, the scale of the monuments, etc., are much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
We started with Khiva, which was the capital of a small kingdom. And the scale of the architecture reflects that.
Mm-hmm.
If you come to Samarkand, you would see that Madrasa in Khiva was maybe a tenth of the size of a madrasa that you would see in Samarkand. So the scale of the monuments is just massive. So that's the first thing that strikes you in Samarkand. Some of the sites in Samarkand would be the tomb of Timur the Lame, the conqueror from Central Asia.
Mm-hmm.
There are, of course, bazaars. There's the Bibi Khanum complex, which is a large mosque that Timur built. It was built based on the riches that he had looted from his sack of Delhi.
Oh, okay.
There is also the highlight of the entire country. So if there was a travel brochure for Uzbekistan, the country, typically the pick on the banner is of the Registan complex.
Mm-hmm.
The Registan complex is a collection of three massive monuments. Two of them, I believe, are madrasas, and the third one is a mosque.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big square, and with three of the sides being dominated by these three buildings, and the fourth side is open.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like the biggest and the best, the most amazing site that you can see in Samarkand. It has been restored, and all of these mosques have their own peculiarities. All of these buildings have their own peculiarities. So the madrasa that is to the left is the Ulugh Beg Madrasa. So word about Ulugh Beg. Ulugh Beg is a descendant of Timur the Lame.
Mm-hmm.
And he was Uzbekistan's Renaissance man. So he's a poet, a philosopher, a scientist, and ruler as well. So he's financed the construction of this madrasa. Astronomy and sciences were among the subjects that were taught there. And you would see that the facade of the madrasa is such that the motif is stars. So it was basically a play on Ulugh Beg's interest in astronomy.
Okay.
Across from it is the Sher Door Madrasa, which I understand means the Lion Door Madrasa. It's because on this madrasa, looking down on you, are motifs of two lions, tigers, one of those. I think they're tigers. They're looking down on you. And again, this goes against what you would typically mm-hmm. expect of a Islamic building, depictions of animist motifs.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the Ulu Beg Madrasa, you can actually bribe the policeman or the cop there, and they'll actually let you go to the top of that minaret. So we actually had an interesting...
I always hesitate when we start mentioning bribery on the Amateur Traveler. I don't know why that is, but
yeah. All right. So, well, we're talking about Central Asia.
I think that's really awesome.
We hired a guide for a private tour of the Registan complex,
mm-hmm.
just because we wanted to appreciate a little bit more about it.
Mm-hmm.
So the guide actually told us that if you speak to the cop for a fee might let you go on top of that minaret. So we walked over to the cop and we asked him if it was possible for us to go to the minaret.
Mm-hmm.
So he asked for a ridiculous amount of money, which I wasn't willing to pay. So I said, no, I'll pass. So then he asked me for my passport. So I had my passport on me. I gave it to him and he flipped through it and he attempted a shakedown.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how much of that you want to add into your show, but just an interesting recollection. He attempted a shakedown, but nothing came of it.
I'm thinking I might have said, I don't have my passport on me. I sort of saw the shakedown coming from the, do you have your passport? I think it's back in my hotel might have come out of my lips there.
Anyway, so no damage done. So, the Registan complex is impressive. I mean, just from the outside looking in, mm-hmm. when you're just standing in the square looking at these buildings, they are impressive just from the facade. And the third building there is a mosque.
Mm-hmm.
And the central part of that mosque is called the Tilakkari Dome or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that is unbelievably intricate. So if you go there, you can spend minutes until your neck starts to ache just looking at the roof. It is so beautifully done. The interesting thing is, if you go inside the mosque and you look up,
mm-hmm.
you would think that they have painted it on a dome. So basically, you would see that the motifs are shrinking and it is all converging towards an apex. But that's actually entirely an illusion, because when you go out of the mosque and you look at it from the outside, there is no dome over that part of the mosque. So the entire tile work, the painting, etc., that they've done on that roof basically has been done in a way to create this optical illusion that they have a dome over them when it's actually a flat roof.
Oh, okay. Interesting. I've seen that in a few churches. I've never seen that in a mosque. That's interesting.
Another site which I found very fascinating was the Shah-e-Zinda complex.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the translation is the living king. So Shah-e-Zinda translates as the living king.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what it is actually a necropolis. It's a collection of graves, and I understand that important people for centuries, I believe from about the 9th century to the 19th century, have been buried in this complex.
Hmm.
And there are elaborate tombs, mausoleums in this complex. Now, the namesake is actually one of the earliest followers of the Prophet Muhammad. He was trying to bring the message of Islam to Central Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And while he was right here, so in this complex, he was assassinated. So somebody came in, chopped his head off, and this person, he coolly got up, his headless body. He picked up his head, the legend says, and then he went and hid in a well.
Okay.
So he's the living king. He's not dead. He just happens to be living in the well.
Okay.
That's the legend. Strangely, there's also a burial mound, so a grave for the living king. I just found that a little odd.
A grave for the living king. Yeah, okay, that would be a little odd.
These are basically a collection of mausoleums. They're very beautiful, intricate, lot of calligraphy in various languages, Farsi, Arabic,
mm-hmm.
lot of tile work. To me, this particular site was a highlight. A highlight also that one of the Uzbek families who were there visiting, they were very intrigued with tourists like myself.
Mm-hmm.
So they spent 15 minutes trying to make conversation with us, and we had to pose for pictures with every person of their family and all of that. It was an interesting experience. And all of this jovial atmosphere and, you know, conversations are happening in what is essentially a cemetery.
Well, you mentioned this being an older part of the city, an old. The one thing we didn't say is that we're talking about quite possibly the oldest inhabited city in Central Asia. They don't know when the city was founded, but maybe 7th or 8th century BC. I mean, just an ancient, ancient city. I don't know if there are portions of it that are still around that go that far back or not.
There is a site called the Afrosia.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hill, and this necropolis, the Shah Zinda, is adjacent to it.
Okay.
But that is the old part of Samarkand.
Okay.
It is a lot of ruins and dust heaps. Possibly it may get excavated and things will emerge from it that can be restored in a way that lay tourists like me can appreciate. I saw very little of it.
Okay.
To me, it was not the highlight of my time in Samarkand. But I am aware of that Afrosiab area being the ancient center of Samarkand.
Interesting. Okay.
One of the sites we visited in Samarkand was a tomb of Saint Daniel. Now, I did not know that there are multiple cities in the world that claim to have the tomb of Saint Daniel.
Okay.
Samarkand is one of those cities.
And we're talking about Daniel and the lion's den, Daniel.
That Daniel, yes.
Okay. Interesting.
So that is Samarkand. Another trip we took from Samarkand is to the city of Shahrisabz. This is the birthplace of Timur the Lame.
Okay.
This is also a very good experience. I mean, we found a driver just outside of our hotel. His name was Ilhom. And we chartered him for the day. We told him that, you know, yes, we want to go to Shahrisabz for the day. But before that, we want to have some Samarkand pulao, which is their national dish. And apparently Samarkand does the best.
Okay. And I've heard this before, but I have forgotten what is in that dish.
It is rice, meat, and vegetables.
Okay.
It's typically cooked in a vessel that looks like a wok.
Okay.
So it's rice with lots of oil and meat and vegetables. It is similar to Iranian pilaf.
Okay.
Kind of similar to an Indian pulao.
Got it.
So a driver, he takes us to a restaurant. The restaurant had no name. The restaurant had no menu. So we go into this restaurant and we are the only tourists there. You don't really have to ask for anything because they only serve one dish, which is the pulao.
Okay.
So they count the number of chairs occupied around the table and they'll bring you a portion that is right for those many people. It was the best pulao I had in Uzbekistan.
Now, unfortunately, you can't give us directions back to that place.
I cannot give you directions to that place. But if you are in Samarkand and you want a day trip to Shahrisabz, or if you want to charter a taxi, ask for Ilhom in front of the Gur Emir Mausoleum.
Okay.
Sometimes when you meet people on your travels, it's the people that make the journey.
Mm-hmm.
So Ilhom is one such guy. And he had a smile on his face every second of the day. He was the most friendly guy. He was so keen to ensure that you have a good time. He spoke no English, and we didn't speak any of the languages that he spoke. So a lot of miming through the day, but we are glad that we chartered this guy as our driver for that day.
Excellent. Anything else we want to cover in Uzbekistan before we get to some of the wrap-up questions?
Sure. So I did mention the grave of Imam Bukhari.
Yes.
That was something we did on the last day. We squeezed it in. So it's a short trip outside of Samarkand. So we took a taxi or a public bus, I don't recall, and we got there. And the amazing thing about this mausoleum is that a lot of Islamic countries came together because they all respect and honor Imam Bukhari and his work. So one country offered the money, another country sent the marble, the third country sent in the artisans. So essentially it's a collaborative effort of many Islamic countries: Iran, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Uzbekistan. Those are the names I recall, several other countries. that was a very spiritual site. I'm not Muslim. I am not observant in any religion. Mm-hmm. But when you go to that place is certainly spiritual. And you can feel it. So one of the memories I had is there was this person, again, this is Sufi Islam. So normally visiting graves is frowned upon in Islam. And singing and music is also frowned upon. But here there was a professional singer. So anybody who wanted to be blessed or somebody, that's my understanding, I don't understand the language. So you would give him some money and he would sing a prayer for you or he would call out a blessing for you in the most melodic voice. I mean, it was beautiful. You could just sit there and listen to this guy for basically less than a dollar. He would, with his beautiful voice, he would, you know, just fill the space. And it was a very spiritual experience.
Interesting. What surprised you about Uzbekistan? Was it what you expected?
It was what I expected on steroids.
Okay.
And what surprised me was how welcoming the people were. So I knew I was going to look at these Silk Road sites, and I knew that, you know, there is a culture of hospitality in that region.
Sure.
But how welcoming the people are, you cannot quantify that. Everywhere you go, people are happy to see you. People greet you with big smiles. For example, in Shakri Sabz, I was walking along the road and there was a shop selling soft serve ice cream. So I went and I asked for a soft serve ice cream. They gave me the ice cream but refused to take money. Another place in Samarkand, this is right by the Gur Emir Mausoleum. One of their fast food items is a samsa, which is like the Indian samosa.
Okay.
So it's pastry dough with some fillings inside it. I got one. I just wanted a light snack. But this guy, he saw that I was a tourist, whatnot. He came and he offered us a second one for free and he refused to take money. So random acts of kindness. So another thing that I would do is if you're wandering the city, taking in the sights, if you get tired, typically what I would do is I would just walk into a mosque when it is not prayer time, and I would just catch a power nap.
Okay.
I did it twice, and both times, similar experiences. So we went into a mosque, we leaned against the wall, and we're trying to get some shut eye, and somebody who's probably the caretaker or the priest of the mosque, he comes by, and we are not quite asleep, so we see him approaching. So he sees us, he makes some conversation, he asks, where are you from and are you Muslim? And I never hesitate, you know, if they ask me this question, I tell them I'm not. And in both cases, it didn't affect their, I mean, there was a language problem. In this particular case, he just went away, he asked us to wait and he went away. And I wasn't sure how he's going to react. Either he's going to come with a stick and wave us and he's going to bring a stick and he's going to you know, slap us out of the mosque or what. Instead, he went and he came back with a kettle of tea and two cups and he poured us tea.
I was going to bet on tea. Okay.
Yes. So their hospitality and how happy they are to see you is something that, you know, you cannot really expect. You cannot hope for such a welcome in most places.
Well, and I'm curious now, when you are asked where you're from, we were talking before the show that you are originally from Mumbai, but you are now from New York. How do you answer the question when people ask where you're from?
I usually tell them I'm from India.
Okay.
So it depends on the context. So for example, if I'm checking into a hotel and they need my documents.
Sure. Then you're from the U.S.
Then I'm from the U.S.
Right.
But if I'm meeting someone in a mosque and they ask me where I'm from, then I'm from India.
Okay. Interesting. Before we get to our three wrap-up questions, anything else we should know before we go to Uzbekistan?
Just go.
Most beautiful spot. You're standing in the most beautiful spot. Where are you standing? What are you looking at?
For me, that is, you are in the town of Khiva. You are inside the walled fort. So some people say that if you're walking along the wall, along the top of the wall, which you can do, that it gives a very good vantage of what Khiva is. To me, if you're inside the walled city, in a perspective that you really cannot see the modernity outside. Okay. Everything that you're seeing is within this medieval town. That, to me, is the best sight in Uzbekistan.
Excellent. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Uzbekistan.
So there are a couple of things. A lot of people gild their teeth. So you will see a lot of golden teeth. That, to me, is something which is very Uzbek.
Interesting. I would not have expected that. You said a couple things. What was the other thing?
The other one is they consider a unibrow as a sign of beauty. So you would find many women actually pencil their eyebrows such that they appear as a single unibrow. And that also, I've only seen in Uzbekistan.
That is quite different. Interesting. And if you had to summarize Uzbekistan in three words, what three words would you use?
I would say welcoming.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Historical.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
Delicious. I haven't talked about the food, but the food was generally...
We talked a little bit about the food. We talked about plov.
Yes.
And where we can't find the best plov restaurant, where we can search for the best plov restaurant.
So, I didn't have a bad meal in Uzbekistan.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much. Our guest again has been Latish Sharma. And Latish does not at this time have a travel blog, so we won't talk about where we can read about your travels, but you're hearing them here on Amateur Traveler. Latish, thank you so much for coming on Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your newfound love for Uzbekistan.
Thank you for having me.
I'm going to skip the news from the community this week because I'm packing for a trip. I was home just last night from a trip in Europe, and I'm packing for a trip to San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, tomorrow. But I'm not anticipating that we're going to miss any weeks of the show. We'll see whether I can keep that up. If you're listening to the show before November of 2017, remember we still have space on our trip to India. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. You can follow me on Twitter, Pinterest, or Instagram as Chris2X. And as always, thanks so much for listening. I got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more cafe. I should be